And good morning. While council is getting set up and comfortable, I will call the next case on our calendar and welcome you to the courtroom as well. The next case that we'll be hearing this morning is Audrey Maria Negri versus Chad Andrew Pattenbinder, case number A220658. And I'll give you a few moments to get ready. You both ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So once again, welcome. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for argument. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before you begin your argument, please just make sure you identify yourself and the party that you're representing. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Jonathan Snyder. I represent the appellant in this matter, Audrey Negri, N-E-G-R-I. We come to the court today to address the issue of statutory interpretation as it relates to HROs. That statute is 609-748 subdivision 2. Under the statute, 609-748 subdivision 2 is a standing statute. Our argument rests on the person argument, which is statutory review is a de novo standard of review, which means that the court does not need to give deference to the trial court in this case. I would like to first talk a little bit about the facts of this case and the procedural posture about how we got here. So in January 2022, the petitioner, Audrey Negri, who was a minor at the time, 15 years old, filed for a petition for the district court as she was seeking a harassment restraining order. The petition included unwanted sexual comments made towards her by her biological father, who is the respondent in this case, and it included suicidal ideation as well as suicidal attempts by the appellant in this case. Shortly thereafter, the referee Larmouth, who also heard or also made the decision for dismissal, decided that the harassment had occurred, there are reasonable grounds to believe harassment had occurred, and there was an imminent threat that harassment would continue. She did not give a hearing date for respondent, and appellant did not request one if HRO was granted. The HRO was granted for a period of 2 years, so until January 7th, 2024. Respondent did request a hearing, as is his right, and that hearing was held on March 4th, 2022. It was also a mediation session to resolve the issues, which did not come to a full decision or a full agreement between the parties. And we proceeded with written briefs directed by the judicial officer at the district court. Following a three-week time period, we submitted simultaneous briefs on the issue, which happened to be appellant's 16th birthday. On April 11th, 2022, the court dismissed the claim, stating that the appellant in this case was not a person enumerated by the statute. And the court cited subdivision 2, sentence 2 at the time, which stated a step-parent, parent, or guardian may file on behalf of a minor. The argument that we made was not really addressed by the court. The court only made three findings. One was the name of appellant, the age of appellant, and the one I just stated, which is a conclusion, maybe not so much a finding. What we're asking the court is to read person in the statute as consistently as it, appellant is looking for the court to show that the term person should be consistent throughout. I would like to cite a few.
I just wanted to follow up, and I'm sure you're probably going to get to this, but if there wasn't that phrase, in the manner provided in this section, and that wasn't there then, and it just started out a person, totally understand your position and probably support it. But given that phrase there, you know, why are we just looking to define person by looking at other parts of the statute or the OFP law or other things, as opposed to, oh no, we've got to go and look at the rest of the section, which then refers, as you know, to the parents and guardians.
Yeah, and I would say that, I mean, I looked at section as like a Minnesota statute, section 609-748. So I look at that term as section meaning the entirety of the statute itself, rather than the subdivision itself. When I look at the entire section, there are other arguments about, or there are other descriptions such as a respondent can be an adult and a juvenile, which juveniles are typically people above or below the age of 18. And then when you go down to the remedies that the court is allowed to, or I guess the violations that the court is allowed to find, you see the word person every time from subdivision 6 down through from A to F. So it talks about a person violating an HRO can do this. We see that as an all-inclusive person, meaning a juvenile, adult, and even a corporation that might be soliciting and harassing somebody on their behalf. If you look at the term person in subdivision 4, which actually for about 3 months respondent was subjected to a temporary order for harassment restraining, it makes him cease harassment of a person. It makes him cease contact of that person. And if subdivision 5, following a hearing, it also uses the term person, that the respondent would be the one ceasing harassment of that person, that they would be ceasing the harassment or the contact of that person.
Mr. Snyder, I know you make two alternative arguments in your brief as to, you know, whether the plain language of the statute controls or another argument regarding what we should do if we conclude that the statute is ambiguous. But do you agree that if we end up going to that second issue of whether the statute is ambiguous and concluding that it is, given the 2022 amendment, you're kind of done. Your position necessarily loses.
So, given the 2022 amendment, I believe that supports the position that the legislator believed that minors can petition on behalf of themselves. And I feel like my argument would be that if the appellant were to pursue that grounds on the fact that she was emancipated, I guess my concern is that, my concern would be that, what comes first, the chicken or the egg at that point? Do you determine that the person is emancipated by pleadings? Because I don't think that's possible. I feel like you would have to give the minor an opportunity to be heard. The statute for the harassment restraining order does allow for people or for the judicial officer to dismiss frivolous claims, regardless of the harassment. So my confusion would be, do you first order the ex parte harassment and then require a hearing? Because in that case, the minor would be required to have a hearing and they can file on behalf of themselves regardless. I guess my point being that if you need to make a determination that emancipation has occurred, you would need to have factual findings to determine that that has occurred. And I don't know if that, if I guess there hasn't been any case law on that yet because it's a new amendment. So my concern would be that a minor would be trying to prove one before the other, as emancipation would be a threshold issue prior to the harassment restraining order moving forward.
So can I ask a...
Of course.
Are you done? Okay, I didn't want to interfere here. So even if we were to find that the language is ambiguous, so then we can look at legislative history, why would we look to a statute that wasn't in effect yet when this harassment petition for a harassment restraining order was brought and was considered and decided by the court? I mean, is that even relevant? I mean, who knows what the legislature in 2022, maybe they recognized that, wait a minute, we don't want every minor to be able to. That's what the statute currently provides. We want to limit a minor's ability to seek a harassment restraining order to only minors who are emancipated or can establish that they've been emancipated. So why should we be talking about a statute? I'm assuming it only went into effect this August. I haven't looked up the effective date, but can we look at it?
So just to point out a couple procedural things, the decision by the district court was April 11th. The amendment, or the notice of appeal was filed May 11th from appellant, and the statute went into effect in late May of 2022.
Oh, it went into effect in late May 2022.
Right.
Okay.
So just to clear that up, I think you're within your discretion to look at these new amendments. I think that the relevant statute here is the 2020 version, or the version prior to the amendment. So we're looking at the term person, and appellant's argument is that we see it as an addition. So we start with a person, and if we see the step-parent, parent, and guardian as more of an enumerated list that discusses whether or not, or I guess provides a support person for that minor if they need to seek counsel or whatever that the case may be, or if they need some time to figure out what they want to do or talk to somebody about the harassment. So we see that as in addition to, not or. So when we look at...
So this raises a whole nother question in my mind. So if we were to say, okay, problem with the district court's ruling, we're going to remand, then I'm assuming we're under the new statute at that point? I mean, it wouldn't be retried under the old. I don't know the answer to that question. Just an issue for thought. And you can go on with your argument.
Just quick, my understanding would be that it would be under the old statute if you do remand it.
If I may just clarify, and that's because you agree that the 22 amendments are not retroactive.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
So I just want to briefly talk about the relationship between respondent and appellant. Respondent advances some arguments about how a parent should bring this. If you look at respondent's memo that was submitted to the district court, you'll see about 70 pages worth of custody files that was your custody orders that was ordered on behalf or by referee Stebbins in Hennepin County. It is the respondent's and appellant's mother custody case. It's about a decade long. It discusses a restriction on appellant's mother's parenting time, so much so that she was limited to about 2 Zoom hearings. So if you make the argument, Zoom hearings for parenting time a week at that point. So if you're making the argument that a parent should bring this, one, the respondent is a parent, obviously wouldn't bring HRO on behalf of appellant to make him stop harassing her. Second, if you're looking at the option of frivolity or whether or not these allegations are credible, I think respondent would say that appellant's mother is maybe the least credible person he knows, the findings in the custody hearing, which appellant obviously disagrees with, and she wants to see your mother, so she's limited to these times once or twice per week to talk to her. If she were to ask her mother to go ahead and file on her behalf, there's a potential for a contempt motion because she's not supposed to be discussing these court issues or bringing actions that could even limit her time even more than they already have.
I just want to be clear, Mr. Snyder, you're now making a policy argument, but do you agree we wouldn't even get to your policy argument if we concluded that the language of the statute was unambiguous?
Yeah, I guess I'm making alternative arguments. First, I want to make sure that the court understands the basis of this claim is that the appellant is seeking a ruling from the court discussing what the meaning of the statute is first. The second argument is if you find that it's ambiguous, we ask that you look at this custody case that is in Hennepin County and make a determination about whether or not maybe there is a parent that's able to bring a harassment training order, but not so much legally able to, seeing as appellant wants to see her mom, she's limited to this amount, she wants to make sure she keeps seeing her mom, and she didn't want to bring her mom into this. Appellant has made every effort to make this between her and respondent. Respondent seems to think that appellant is an agent for her mother to basically undermine his parental authority and undo whatever was said in the Hennepin County case. That is simply not the case. She's trying to make this about her. She pursued this appeal because she's trying to make this case between respondent and appellant, and she is a person under the statute that can bring a HRO on her own behalf. we see in the statute that person is talked about consistently, and I don't think it's a good reading of the statute to say the person is one thing in subdivision 2, but person is another thing in subdivision 6, subdivision 4, subdivision 5, or whatever. I do want to quickly talk about a persuasive authority that was cited in both briefs. It's Steps to Success versus Dowell, I believe, was the last name. It's where a corporation brought a HRO on behalf of teens that were in their care. The district court said that the second sentence with the step-parent, parent, and guardian was exclusive, and the corporation did not have standing to bring it on behalf. So again, we're looking at it more as an addition to the person. It did say that the respondent recognized that, in that case, recognized that, I'm out of time, sorry. Can I finish my thought?
Finish your thought, okay. Yes, please.
Respondent in that case did recognize that Steps itself was a person under the law because it was a corporation that could file on behalf of themselves but couldn't be on behalf of the minor. So that's what we're looking for. She's a person under the statute. We're looking through the court to discuss the statutory language first and then the alternative arguments thereafter. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes if you want to talk about that case more or anything else during your rebuttal. We will next hear from counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Tiffany Wolter, and I'm here to represent the respondent in this matter, Chad Patton Minder. We're here today essentially to determine whether or not a minor child has standing to apply for a harassment restraining order pursuant to Minnesota Statute 609-748, Subdivision 2. We believe the answer to that question is no. The statute provides that a person who is a victim of harassment or the victim's guardian or conservator may seek a restraining order from the district court in the manner provided in this section. The parent, the guardian or conservator, or step-parent of a minor who is a victim of harassment may seek a restraining order from the district court on behalf of the minor. Appellant believes that the statute is unambiguous and that the minor may apply for a petition because they are a person. This is not correct. The court's first step to determine whether or not the statute is ambiguous is to look to the wording of the statute and to look to the legislative intent.
Well, actually, we don't get to the legislative intent, right, if the wording of the statute's plain, correct?
No. The court also has to review what, in the case of Christensen v. Hinkey, it clearly states that the court is also to look at the intent of the legislature in the wording of the statute, not
well,
necessarily
that's the ultimate goal, correct?
Correct.
But we look just, if it's unambiguous, we look just to the words and their plain and ordinary meaning.
Correct. You look at the meaning of the words, but you also have to take into consideration what was the intent of the legislature. Not necessarily the legislative history of the case, but what was the legislature intending to convey in the wording of the statute. So if
we conclude that the statute's unambiguous...
Correct.
It seems like your argument requires us to add the word only or a like word into the second sentence. So what would authorize us to do that? I mean, a person is a human being. I mean, that's right. And a human being includes everything from an infant all the way up, although I suppose let's not get there at that end of things, you know, all the way up through somebody in their hundreds, but they are a person. And so how do you get around asking us to add words to the language of the statute?
I'm not asking you to add words to the statute. What I'm asking you to do is interpret the actual words that are written in the statute. Because the statute says that you apply for it in the manner suggested by the statute itself. The statute itself says that minors apply for the order through their parent, their guardian, their conservator, or their step-parent.
So just to be clear, your argument is that that first sentence that uses the word person is sort of like an introductory sentence to that particular subsection of the statute, and that what follows are the proper standing procedures for the different groups discussed.
Correct. Yes. That you can't read, the two sentences aren't disjunctive. The appellant cites no statutory authority for why we should read these two sentences completely separately. The two sentences should be read together. That a person may apply in this manner, and then the manner for application for a minor is this way. That's how the statute reads.
And I would be more persuaded by that if the phrase was in the manner provided in this subdivision. And as Mr. Snyder points out, it says section, and the section also includes subdivision 6, right?
Correct.
Which talks about person in terms of both adults and juveniles, right? So doesn't that at least make this ambiguous?
Well, I mean, I don't believe it does, but that could be something that the court determines.
And if we do determine that it's ambiguous, are we permitted to consider subsequent legislation?
Yes. Yes.
Under what authority?
Under the court is to interpret statutes pursuant to Minnesota Statute 645-16.
And that doesn't mention subsequent legislation, though.
The contemporaneous legislative history, right? So my interpretation is contemporaneous is we take a look at what the legislative history is of the act, right? And it's been amended multiple times. It started out in 1990 by saying that adults, persons, apply in district court and minors then apply in juvenile court. So it's very clear, at least in 1990, that these two, that this statute had one process for adults, persons, and one process for minors that happened in the juvenile court.
Yeah, and perhaps I wasn't clear. I think there's any debate about whether we can consider prior legislative history. My question really concerns the 2022 amendment and whether that's fair game as well as we're attempting to determine the legislature's intent.
Right. Well, I think when you're looking at the legislative intent in this, in respondent's memorandum that was filed with the court, respondent cites to or provides Exhibit B in that memorandum, which is essentially a bill summary that was done by the Minnesota House. And in that bill summary, it clearly says that what they were trying to do with the amendment was to make it so that minors would have more ways to apply for a restraining order. It says, under current law, a petitioner for harassment restraining order, must be brought by minor's parents, guardian, or conservator. This bill would permit some emancipated minors to file to petition for a restraining order on their own behalf. So clearly, the reason why the statute was amended was because the legislature itself believed that their language restricted the minor's ability to file for a harassment restraining order, and something needed to be done to change it.
Couldn't it be the opposite, though? Couldn't they have said, heck, not all minors should be able to, only emancipated, so we're going to limit. Yeah. I mean, why should we come to your conclusion?
Because that's not what the legislator themselves said.
Is that are you quoting from what the legislators themselves said or from a staff report?
From the staff report.
Okay, I just think that there's a difference when we're looking at legislative history. Is that a and what was that staff report again? Was it a, it wasn't a result of a conference committee, for an example, correct?
It just is a summary of what of why the House needed to amend. It's from Ben analyst Ben Johnson from the House.
Okay, so it's a House staff analyst.
Yes,
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
So my understanding was is the reason why the House in the or the legislature took this up was because they believed that there was a problem that they needed to correct, not that it was too expansive and that they needed to shorten it. I don't believe, when we're looking at whether or not the statute is ambiguous or not, there are different canons that we take a look at. And when we take a look at the actual statute itself, too, there are, so in the first sentence of the statute, it states that a person or the person's guardian or conservator may file on their behalf. And then in the second section, it says the minor's parents, or the minor's guardian or conservator may apply on their behalf. Why would the legislature, if a minor was a person, why would the legislature have in both sentences that the guardian or conservator may apply for the order, right? If it were simply that the legislature was trying to add another way for minors to apply, the statute would read very differently. It would probably read something like, you know, let's see, a person who is a victim, including a minor, right? And, you know, something of that nature.
What about subdivision 6 of the statute? That is one of the clues that appellant points to that supports appellant's reading of the statute. And that subdivision specifically deals with criminal liability for violating a harassment restraining order. And there, it refers to a person.
Mm-hmm. That is talking about after there's been an application, after there's been an adjudication, and then what happens to the respondent, right? So that isn't talking about the petitioners, that is talking about the respondents. And in this case, I don't necessarily know that there are a couple of procedural requirements where the court where the legislature has gone in and said minors need more procedures because their parents need to know, but in referring to the respondents, the legislature may have used the word person, but it hasn't used the word person to accompany minors in as related to the petitioners. So I don't believe that that is a that's an inconsistency. Appellant talked a little bit about the facts of the case and this policy argument, essentially, that in this case, Audrey Nagiri, her one parent is so restricted that she can't file the order on her behalf or she can't talk to that parent about that. But I think that Audrey currently lives with her maternal grandparents, and there is nothing that would prevent her from talking to her maternal grandparents and from her maternal grandparents then in turn telling mother, hey, we need a harassment restraining order, go and apply for it.
Well, would you also agree that there are other policy considerations that may support your argument that not every minor should be allowed to obtain a harassment restraining order willy-nilly?
Absolutely. I would not want my 11-year-old daughter to be able to go down to the courthouse and file a harassment restraining against me or her father without one of us knowing or without one of us having the ability to say, yeah, do that, or no, don't do that. I think that in this case in particular, this is a situation where the court has made multiple findings that mom has alienated these children and mentally manipulated them. And so that is why the legislature, I'm sure, has this requirement that somebody needs to file this order on behalf of this child in order for it to come in. Because the courts have long recognized that minors have, minors don't have the ability to contract. Minors don't have the ability to do a lot of different things because minors don't necessarily, understand the world or what's going on or have the capability to, be fully developed and understand what they're doing. So I think it's very important
that... But apparently they do have the capability so that a harassment restraining order can be entered against them.
Correct, but their parents also have to be notified, right? I mean, the statute... Right, the statute is the other way too. In that, the respondents, there's clear guidance here that parents need to be a part of if a application is being, put on against a respondent who is a minor too. I also want to talk about the Steps case. In the Steps case, the court did determine that the only one that could file, or that, the organization itself could not file on behalf of the residents there. But I want to point out to the court, in the Steps case, on page 3, there is one paragraph that addresses how minor children, the minor residents of the facility, were dealt with, and then there's a separate paragraph for the child, or the adult, the 18-year-old that lives in there. On page 3, it discusses that the only way that the minor residents of the facility would be able to apply for this harassment restraining order is if, the parent, guardian, or step-parent applied for it. Yet in the second paragraph right after that, it talks about the 18-year-old resident and indicates that that resident would then have the ability to apply on her own.
So that raises a question if it would be okay.
Please go ahead.
Presiding judge,
yes.
I can ask. That was a non-presidential opinion, right? So given the statutory interpretation issue, should we be issuing a presidential opinion in response to this case? And if so, what should our holding be?
Yes, I do believe that this is an issue that probably would require a presidential opinion. And I think that obviously the court should affirm the district court in this and say that minors are not a part of the definition of person and able to file on their own, that minors need to have a parent, guardian, or a step-parent apply on their behalf, as section 2 or sentence 2 of the statute states. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Snyder, you will have 5 minutes.
I just want to briefly touch on the heart of the issue, which I think the legislature's intent is to protect Minnesota's victims. It is not an intent to limit as much as possible. We focus on a lot of what they did say, but what they didn't say was adults. They didn't say corporation. They could have easily enumerated those. They used may. They didn't use shall. They didn't, as Judge Siegel pointed out, they decided to use the term, they didn't say only. They said may. They said these three people or these three entities are allowed to petition on behalf of a minor. So I think we have two sections of victims here. We have one that's you can file on your own behalf, and then it allows for a second set of petitioners who can file on somebody else's behalf. When you're looking at subdivision 4 and 5, you're discussing a person who is being granted relief temporarily or permanently following a hearing that they are the ones that are protected by the law. They are the ones where it's being attached to them. It's not being attached to the parent. The respondent would be able to communicate with a parent that brings the action. They wouldn't be able to communicate with the minor child that the action was brought on behalf of. So if we're looking at the term person again, I'm sorry to use the word person so many times, but I think we're running a field and we're trying to do linguistic gymnastics and saying what they meant rather than what they said. The judiciary is the ones that are supposed to interpret the law while the legislatures write them. An interpretation, I believe it's arguable that it should be consistent throughout a single statute. We are not looking at other statutes. We are looking at the same one that discusses adult respondents and juvenile respondents and then combines the two. So much so that a peace officer, if they have reasonable belief that a person has violated a harassment restraining order, they can go ahead as long as it's easily feasible to find that harassment restraining order, they can arrest them with probable cause, whether that be a juvenile or an adult. So I guess where appellant is just hoping the court reads it as consistently as she does. We believe that she, as a person, can petition on behalf of herself and is not required for a parent, step-parent, or guardian, or conservator to do it on her behalf. I will say that I wanted to address one of the arguments that respondent made with guardian or conservator being used the same. I think Steps kind of points that out because it discusses, and to your point, it's not a precedential opinion, but I think it's persuasive in that the legislature was looking to limit it to those three things. They wanted to make sure those were enumerated. They used exclusive canons of construction, which said no one else but these three people or three entities can do this. So I think in looking at that specific sentence and the interpretation, although persuasive, you're looking at a point that the legislature was wanting to limit those things. Now, it's a whole other argument, and I'll briefly close on the persuasive argument, or not persuasive, a policy argument where this Steps case was in 2009. We look at OFPs where residential and familial relationships are allowed to bring OFPs on behalf of minor children. For example, Subdivision 4 of 518B.01 discusses a 25-year-old can bring an action for an OFP on behalf of a minor so long as it's in the minor child's best interest. So we're looking at a more progressive statute with the OFP that allows for non-familial relationships or non-guardian or conservator relationship being allowed to bring it on behalf of a minor. So I think that the interpretations of the Steps may be outdated in terms of the progressive nature of an OFP statute, which also is intended to protect victims. And I want to close with just saying that I believe, or appellant believes, and I believe that the legislature's ultimate intent is to protect its victims, not to limit them.
So can I ask one quick question? So what do we do with the hypothetical 11-year-old? And what's a judge to do with that if we agree with your interpretation of the statute?
So under the harassment restraining order statute as it was written when appellant filed.
Or 9-year-old, whatever, but somebody who's, competent to testify, old enough to be found competent.
Understood. So under the statute that appellant filed under, I think it's subdivision 3 of the 609-748, the judicial officer, if it finds there's no merit to those claims, it can throw it out. But if you're looking at the 2022 amendment, you're alleging emancipation as well as harassment. So it's actually making it more difficult on the judiciary because you're having to first determine a threshold issue. I don't know if the harassment comes before the determination of emancipation. So if you're deciding that emancipation comes after, then she or he files an ex parte HRO order against a respondent. Then they have a hearing about the emancipation. So under the reading of the statute as it was written, I think it's easier for the judiciary to throw out maybe those frivolous appeals as it is now. Thank you. I'm out of time. Appreciate it.
Thank you both very much for your arguments this morning, which were very helpful. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.